Right. Good evening, everyone. So really, really good to see you all, and fantastic that the church is warm. We've had heating on all day, and it's been warm outside, so that's been great. Let me introduce Adrian, a few words, and that what we'll then do is then we'll have a few moments of quiet before he gets going, just so we can all still down. And then Adrian's going to lead us through the whole of the hour, mixing talk with a bit of interaction and involving you. So I'll just hand over to him and finish at the end. Adrian, I mean, it's funny when you come to introduce someone who's actually very, very important and special, but he's just been an old mate of mine for some years now, mainly through, we've known each other through the work at Modern Church. But Adrian was 20 years vicar of a church in Sheffield, St. Mark's Sheffield, and also while he was there started up something, he may mention this, St. Mark's Centre for Radical Christianity, which had a series of speakers from actually all over the world exploring what it might be, what it might mean to be a radical Christian. And that was quite a significant thing in Sheffield. The recent years he's been chair of the Progressive Christian Network, or PCN for those who are in it, and one or two of you may have heard of that as well. Oh, there are leaflets about the Progressive Christian Network at the back, as also there are copies of Adrian's book with the price there, so please don't go home empty-handed. Anyway, let's just give ourselves a moment of quiet before we begin, and then I'll hand over to Adrian. So, Adrian, a very, very warm welcome, and it's very good to have you here.
Well, thank you very much, Tim, and thank you, Tim and Susie. I've been very well fed, and so well fed that I hope I don't fall to sleep. I'll have to keep awake so that I make you keep awake, but it's been lovely to spend a little bit of time across at the vicarage and catching up. It's also good to be back here. I think, like one or two of you, you begin to wonder where the years have gone. And 3 weeks ago, a group of us met at Wadham down the road because it was 50 years since we first came up to study here. It doesn't seem possible, but there it is. And 10 years later, after 67, I came back to do theology, and that was at Cuddesdon, so I lived not far away in Wheatley when I was newly married at that point. So it's good to be back, and thank you very much, everybody, for the invitation to be part of this series of discussions. I was very flattered when Tim said that his colleagues and he had been looking at the book and found it helpful. And that's really kind, and I know some of you may have read it, and if you found it helpful, that's great, and I'd love your feedback. Let me tell you briefly, very briefly, a couple of minutes about where I'm coming from, because often when I listen to people speak, I think, you know, where are they coming from? What's led them to say and be and who they are? I've had a very happy 38 years ministry in the Church of England, which is more than many of my colleagues can say, really. I've been very fortunate. When I left here to go back to my sponsoring Diocese of Liverpool, I had what, for me, I'm not really a great fan of lots of bishops, and they're not really a great fan of me, but one of my heroes of the faith was David Shepherd, who ordained me in Liverpool Cathedral in 79. And then I had a happy curacy in that fascinating city. That was followed by 5 years in the Diocese of Carlisle, very different context in the Lake District, working as the youth advisor there. There are far more sheep than young people in Carlisle, but we managed to find some of them. And then, as Tim hinted, I came to Sheffield, and that, I suppose, was the most exciting part of my ministry for 20 years when I was within the St. Mark's community, and we began there the Centre for Radical Christianity. And when I left there, I went for my final job to be Director of Mission Resourcing in the Diocese of Leeds and worked for another splendid bishop in John Packer before he retired. And I enjoyed looking at the different ways in which the church could work on many different issues affecting our society. Things like environmental issues, disability issues, racial justice, and so on. And they were a very, very interesting time as well to be in the Church of England and to get another insight as to the kind of, on the managerial side of the Church of England, which was quite revealing in many ways. So that's who I am in terms of my ministry. And I suppose all through that, from my early studying of history here, and perhaps like many of you, I've gone on that kind of critical approach to many things, especially a critical approach to the understanding of historical texts and therefore the Bible, always actually on that kind of open, progressive, awkward, leftish, liberalish, whatever word you want to use, part of the journey. And therefore, through the 80s, certainly, and again, I'm sure many of you identify with this, very much involved in the whole movement for the ordination of women, and so on. So that's where I've been coming from. And I have to say that my convictions haven't really moved very much. They've probably become even more radical as time has gone on. But I come to this topic tonight, and I came to the book, not with a sense of bitterness at all. I may have had a kind of love-hate relationship with the church. I think we all do from time to time. But I've come out of the church in terms of full-time ministry, thankful. Thankful for the communities I've been part of and been able to be part of. So that's something about me. When in 2013, I felt I wanted to somehow sum up where my ministry has led me and in my thinking, it was, of course, in 2013, the 50th anniversary of the book Honest to God. Now, many of you, I noticed somebody has a copy today here. my copy's falling apart. But Honest to God was such a milestone in thought in 1963. And there was a serving bishop of the Church of England at a time when the church was even more established and traditional in many ways than it is today, daring to ask very deep questions about religious language, about religious doctrine, about the future of the church. It might be worth just sharing a quote with you from Robinson's preface, where he says, "For I am convinced," rather Pauline, isn't it? "For I am convinced that there is a growing gulf between the traditional orthodox supernaturalism in which our faith has been framed and the categories which the lay world, for want of a better term, finds meaningful today." And I think it's worth rereading the prologue to Honest to God, because Robinson was clearly not trying to position himself outside the church. He wasn't trying to pick a fight with the traditionalists of the church, with the orthodox positions of the theologians and churchmen of the time. What he was really trying to say was, please give me and others like me space so that you don't regard me as the enemy within, but as another honest seeker after truth, and we will have that kind of dialogue. And the prologue was really trying to engage at that level. But of course, it had quite the opposite reaction in many ways. So although he excited the person on top of the Clapham Omnibus, as it were, and the tabloids of the day were talking about religion and a bishop and faith, nevertheless, Robinson, like the Oxford theologians later on in the late 60s and 70s, found that the church, as it often does, drew the wagons in a circle and started shooting outwards. Well, that was the beginning, in a sense, of a challenge to the Orthodox established church, to give space again to the kind of critical thinking that theologians for the last 200 years had been talking and inviting people to engage with. And I think that what Robinson wanted to do, hence the title, was to engage in an honest debate, to be honest above anything else. And I think running through my own very modest little book was an underlying conviction that we need to be honest about the fruits of historical research about the person, first of all, the person of Jesus. We need to be honest about Jesus as far as we can grasp who Jesus was and what he did and what he said and how he lived and how he died and what was the resurrection about. And that honesty comes, of course, from an honest approach to the scriptures, to see that the scriptures, and it's obvious this, it seems to me, to most people, obvious, I'm sure, to you, that the scriptures are this wonderful mixture of legend and poetry and history and myth and so on. And we need to know that, we need to grasp it, because at the base of all our discussions and arguments about so many issues is this different approach that we all see to scripture and how we can break through this as honestly as possible. And then secondly, in the second part of the book, where first of all then I try to be honest about what the scholars are telling us about Jesus, in the second part I try to say, well, can we be honest about the church as an institution, where it's come from, how it got all these doctrines and formulae in the first place, and how it might move into the present century with a new sense of perhaps being reformed and changed. So I am advocating change, and I'm advocating radical change, and I'll discuss that word radical and like your views on that in a moment or two. But why am I doing this at all? If I've enjoyed my ministry in the church, isn't everything tickety-boo and wonderful? Well, of course, we're facing such sea change, aren't we, today? And we only need to look at statistics to see the kind of challenges that the church faces up to. Two slides, pretty obvious, nothing startling to you. This particular set of statistics is now about 5 or 6 years old. And when this survey was done, this is collated from various surveys, 80% of children now in the UK under 15 no longer attend a church at all, and I'm sure it's much higher now. And look at the closure of churches in the 5-year period up to 2010. The Anglicans, the Methodists, the Pentecostalists, on the other hand, are all those other churches where you may have people coming in from different parts of the world, different ethnic, different nationalities in our major cities. In Leeds alone, we had 47 different churches from Africa, from the African subcontinent and parts of Asia, newly established churches. So that was the kind of pattern. The historic denominations were hemorrhaging and closing churches, and there were new churches, new communities, often from different groups from across the world living in this country. But recently, in one of the General Synod debates, there was somebody raised the fact that if the present forecasts continue, weekly attendances will have fallen by 90% by 2057. I don't think that surprises any of you, particularly. It might surprise us because you belong to a church where, you know, you're not one person and a dog, are you? You know, you're a thriving community. And there are lots of thriving communities. But if you look overall at the pattern, the more interesting still is the British Social Attitude Survey, which was published just a few weeks ago. And in this BSA, the latest BSA survey, in 2016, 53% of respondents said that they did not belong to any particular religion, the nones, as Tim and I have been talking about. And back in 1983, that figure was 31%. For the established Church of England, the percentage of people who associate themselves with the CoV has fallen in that time from 83, from 40 to 15%. And these figures are anxiety-making from those people in the church who have responsibilities for keeping the show on the road. And they're anxiety-making for all of us, but do they present opportunities? Are they to be looked at as quite so bleak? So if we see these projections in our churches, and when I was working in the Diocese of Leeds as a Dawson officer, I would be in a different church most Sundays, especially in North Yorkshire, with lots of rural churches, where the average congregations were so small and the medieval buildings were so splendid, you did wonder what the future was going to hold. So, with this kind of context in mind, and we can talk a lot about the church growth formulas and what the church is trying to do about it, and I'd be interested to have that discussion in a little while, I thought to myself, in collaboration with others, especially in our progressive Christianity movement, but what we need actually is quite a radical change. And I use this word radical because you can use the word radicalism, whether it be in social issues or in politics or in religion. And what did I mean by radical? So I'm going to get you to look at these pictures of people who might be regarded as radicals and just see with your neighbour if you can identify all the faces. You probably will. You may be stuck on one or two. And then I want you to say why you've chosen one of these faces as somebody who you think is radical. Just have a look. Talk with your neighbour. Identify them all. And then tell me who you think is the most radical. Now, I'm sure the good folk of St. Andrews know all the answers, so is there anybody you're stuck with? Okay. On the left, we have Rosa Parks, who refused to give up her seat on that bus. She doesn't look very black there because of the black and white photograph, but believe you me, it is Rosa Parks. On the right is Emmeline Pankhurst. Yeah. I'm only presuming because it happens like this when I give these talks. That is Marie Stopes. George Fox. I think you know the rest, don't you? All right, Jack Spong. And there. Bruce Kent. I think you know this guy at the end. Martin Luther, Tutu, and of course, Mandela. Somebody offer me a name that they think, yeah, she was a radical, and why? Luther, why? Thank you. I think I chose Luther not because I have a great regard for Luther when you think of his anti-Semitic views and so on, but particularly because it was a radical shift as a movement. I mean, when you think of the implications of what Luther started, he really did kick over the traces, didn't he? So in that sense, another offering, somebody else. Mandela. Yeah, that radical sense of compassion and understanding of the enemy, really, the turning of the cheek from his long time in prison and so on. Yeah, thank you. One more. And I think Corbyn represents a kind of, again, a radical shift in perception of what political movements could be after years of either Keynesian economics or neoliberalism. And now we've got something quite different in a way, whether you agree with it or not. Now, obviously, I put that up because I think one of the areas of thought that comes from this word radical is that radicals produce a shift, almost a paradigm shift in thinking, or they can do, or they can present such a challenge to the church, it can create all kinds of repercussions. And when we started the Center for Radical Christianity, we felt that we wanted to say something challenging to the established orthodoxies around religion, and particularly Christianity. But the problem very quickly after 2000 was, of course, and people were coming up to me at St. Mark's saying, Adrian, I think we've got this wrong. We shouldn't use the word radical. Yeah, because if you put radical with Islam, the idea then that radical religion leads to a fundamentalism, leads to a violence, and so on. So there was a little bit of a tussle going on as to whether these awful people, these murderous people, have a right to take over the word radical, which has that honourable history in English political history, people like the Levellers and others, that we would not regard in the same way as we regard radical Islam. So when we look at, again, back to Honest to God, here's the word radical again. This time Robinson saying, excuse the sexist language of the 60s, the true radical is the man who continually subjects the church to the judgment of the kingdom, to the claims of God in the increasingly non-religious world which the church exists to serve. It's gone off the page. But again, you know, he's prepared to use that word radical. The problem with the Church of England, it's hardly a radical institution. And faced up with that word, it kind of either takes fright or it through its clergy, and I'm one of them, and its ministers and others, we try our best to be good and kind and compassionate we try to not upset people too much. So there's this wonderful quote, which I heard Robert Runcie say in his presence. Generally speaking, the Church of England, but you know what Runcie meant when he said, generally speaking, the clergy of the Church of England are generally speaking. And I have great respect for Runcie because as an archbishop, not only was he a good liberal in the cause of women's ordination, but he was prepared to be quite radical at times. Do you remember his sermon after the Falklands War in St. Paul's, where he refused to toe Thatcher's line, where he said, we're going to pray for the dead on all sides? You know, somebody who has the courage to say that. So I have great respect for what Runcie, but what he's really saying is that, you know, the Church of England doesn't like to get too radical about many of these issues. So that leads us to saying, well, in that case, how honest is the Church of England being? Because actually, when we think about Jesus, we might actually think there's a bit of radicalism going on here, which we need to tap into and we need to follow through. So in the first part of the book, being honest about Jesus, I quote from Marcus Borg. Now, if you don't know any Marcus Borg, he was such an influence and such a good writer, and sadly died far, far too soon, 3 years ago. But do read any of Marcus Borg's book, and this one on Jesus, where Marcus says this: for me as a child, the story of Jesus was the most important story in the world. The convictions remain with me, but as I've grown older, I've realized there's an equally important issue: how we tell the story of Jesus. There are many ways of telling this story, and how we tell it matters crucially. And he's not being too benign there. What he's really saying is, folks, you've got to some extent, understand that there's been 200 years of scholarship on the life and teachings of Jesus. And either you listen to the experts, as Michael Gove loves to tell us we shouldn't do, or you don't. But if you do listen, if you do read, if you do learn all the best fruits of scholarship about Jesus, which is really an exciting kind of thing to do, then you will tell the story in such a way as to be truthful and honest, and not with all the overlays that has been put around Jesus. So that, I think, was the basis, really, of what I was trying to do in the first part of the book. Because there is a movement, and it's an obvious movement, and you'll know the movement, from the Jesus of history to the Christ of faith. And so much has been written on this. So many books. I do recommend this book by Maurice Casey, who was professor at Nottingham University, Jesus of Nazareth. And Casey is not only a historian, but also an Aramaic speaker as well. And it's a first class and quite accessible, despite the size, quite accessible read. Now, what I think the nub of the historical research, and most scholars and most clergy and most congregations would say amen to that. Why wouldn't you? How could you disagree that Jesus was a charismatic Jewish teacher influenced by the Baptist? How could you disagree that he was striving for God's impending kingdom, however he understood that? That he was wholly theocentric, Godward in his preaching, that he showed immense compassion, he had a bias to the poor, back to my good old David Shepherd, and the unloved, that he called disciples to a movement, that he confronted the Jerusalem temple authority, and for his trouble thereby he was executed. That is all fairly well agreed, and yet we've come from the Jesus of history to the Christ of faith. So we stand up and affirm that he was the pre-existing Son of God, that he was sent by the Father as the Word of God incarnate, born of the Virgin Mary, a God-man who performed miracles, including nature miracles, that his death on the cross was God's way of restoring fallen humanity through Jesus' own atonement for our sins, through the power of God was raised from earthly death, exalted to God in heaven, and will return from heaven to judge humankind at the general resurrection. The basis statement of faith of Orthodox Christianity throughout its expressions, whether it be in Orthodox, the Church, the Roman Church, the Protestant churches, and so on. And the problem, of course, is that you could unpick those one by one to see how they have developed within the Christian tradition, how they came to be formulated out of the various machinations, if you like, of the churches, but have very little basis in a critical understanding of how those stories came to be there in the Gospels. And of course, there's far more to our Orthodox faith, which has nothing to do with anything that's in the Gospels, in the New Testament as well. So we live with the Christ of faith as the total doctrinal garment around which we clothe Jesus. And sometimes I go back to this painting by Max Ernst, which hangs in Cologne Cathedral, which is a wonderful picture of the Virgin spanking the infant Jesus. And his halo is on the floor, bottom right-hand corner. Now, you know, I show this simply to try to get me to wake up to the fact of who was this Jesus. The Archbishop of Cologne described this painting as blasphemous, of course, because how could a sinless Jesus be spanked? And you know, you get into the whole Christmas stuff, don't you, anyway? I'll keep that on for the moment. In 2017, we're at the stage where, if we're honest, the whole of the Christian world, except perhaps for Unitarians and Quakers and some radicals in different corners and so on, will subscribe to that Orthodox picture of Christianity. That's what Christianity is. That's what we say every Sunday in the Creed and so on. And those are the formularies that we as clergy have to agree to and all that. And yet, the Jesus of history, upon which so much rests, comes at us afresh through the work of scholars and others. And that, it seems to me, is where we're stuck. I think so many people will buy into the Jesus story, buy into this in very radical Jewish teacher, healer, someone who was somehow attuned to the spirit, however we define that, so that in his presence people felt a wholeness and a healing. He had such a challenge to make to the church, to the religion of his day, that for his trouble he was executed. The church, of course, has tried over the centuries to blame others, and let's blame the Jews, let's blame, and so on, and constructed, as we know, the process by which the creeds and the formulas of the church came into being by the fourth century. But I think we need to be honest, not only in facing up to the challenges that the historical Jesus can pose to us in 2017, but actually the challenges to the church to be more honest about how it arrived at some of those formularies, and to explain what it means by that. Is it using it as a form of tradition that we can say, well, it doesn't have to be factually true, but it's part of our tradition, and it's part of our liturgy, and it's part, therefore, perhaps of our spirituality? Well, that's fine, and I wouldn't for a moment, I mean, part of my family is Catholic, my grandson's baptised as a Roman Catholic, in the Roman Catholic Church. I wouldn't want to go around knocking all kinds of dearly held beliefs if it means that people, in a sense, find a basis for their life through, for example, praying the intercessions of the saints or Mary and so on. What I want, and what I think many radical people in the church want, like Robinson wanted, is a space to say, well, if you find that helps you, that's fine. I don't find it helps me, and I don't want my Christianity to be defined quite like you're defining yours, because my Christianity, I want to be defined around the person of Jesus, who becomes the Christ of faith, but I want to interpret that slightly different than you're interpreting that. In other words, I'm trying to nudge the nudge theory rather than throw things out altogether, because I don't think that works. So, for example, in St. Mark's, what we try to do is to say, okay, some people want to stand up and say the creed, so we will have the creed now and again, but we'll not put a health warning. We'll actually say, people want to try and discuss what some of these lines in the creed mean. Let's discuss that. Oh, but this week we're not going to have the Apostles' Creed. We'll actually have an affirmation from Iona, and we'll have this, and therefore it, different ways of expressing what you think you want to affirm speak to different people. So it's a way of trying to accommodate people, but actually at the same time underneath, give them a bit of a radical push to get them talking about, well, I've always held that Jesus was born of a virgin, I'm going to do that till the day I die. Fine. But maybe somebody else doesn't, and therefore let's explore what these things mean and where they've come from. And some people change their mind and some people move on. The second part of the book, though, was being honest about the church. And here I quote Peter Rollins, a youngish man, who in his book Insurrection says this: "The church in its currently existing form is then an institution that helps us to cover our anxiety and encourages us to think that faith is lived out in singing songs, engaging in certain rituals, and believing certain things. The church thus ends up helping us maintain psychological equilibrium and integrate in society as it presently stands, rather than throwing us off balance and being a catalyst for the transformation of society." Whew, that's a lot of quote. But I think you see what Rollins is trying to say is that it's a bit like Runcie in a way. We go along with our rituals and our liturgies, and we do. The church is very good, it seems to me, at doing good. So we staff the food banks, we do all kinds of things, Christian aid, we do lots of things. We're really good at volunteering in community. The churches are the ones who provide the volunteers for all kinds of things. But maybe we're not that good at doing God. Maybe we're not that good at actually being an awkward squad now and again, challenging, back to Corbyn and an awkward challenge sometimes, being somehow, like those other radicals, saying, we really have to strike out because this is wrong. This is not right. This needs to change. And maybe Rollins is saying that, ooh, that will get us all bouncing up and down in the wrong way. We just need to calm down, keep the ship afloat, and be good and kind, But not don't rock the boat too much, because there's too much to lose. And then it becomes again a debate about honesty. What do we honestly think that the radical Jesus would be doing in this situation? You know, the evangelicals don't have all the answers. Maybe some evangelicals here, but you don't have all the answers if you are. They used to have a wristband, didn't they? It said, WWJD, what would Jesus do? Well, I started making those wristbands and giving them out when I was working in the diocese. And they thought, oh, he's a liberal, he doesn't understand that. But you see, I think liberals and radicals can ask the same question. What would Jesus do in these situations? And of course, there are all kinds of situations that we could face. So, for example, the current one where we got ourselves in a total mess. You know, I want to say, let's look critically at the Bible. Of course, I would say that. And then I would want to say, well, I want to base my Christian faith around the person of Jesus. What would Jesus do? What would Jesus say about two people who were in love with each other? And so on. And you know, I will get into the discussions about Jesus said this and Jesus said that and so on. So we have to find a way through that. But what dismays me about the church at the moment in all this debate, it is so timid, really. I mean, the Church of Scotland, you know, God bless the Anglicans in Scotland, they've not been timid about it now. So we need to move on things like this. We need to really say what would Jesus do about some of these issues facing the church today. And then we need to be honest about what we don't believe. A colleague of Tim's, now retired down the road, Brian Mountfort at the University Church here, wrote this book, which some of you have probably read. It's a very interesting read, Christian Atheists. And what Brian did was interview members of his congregation at St. Mary's, students, maybe academics, other folk who come to church, and ask them kind of fundamental questions about, you know, why are you here? What are you doing? What's it about? And he got a wonderful range of honest answers. Many people didn't believe in God, but they loved coming to church for all kinds of reasons. The community, the music, the aesthetics, whatever it was. And he chronicled that in Christian Atheists. I thought, that was so honest, just to reflect about the answers that people gave. So honesty about the church. Let me just pause there and get some reaction to some of the stuff I've said, and throw some bricks at me that I know you won't because you're far too nice, but you know, about how honest are we both about Jesus and about where the church has come from and what's it about? So just let's have some feedback and some buzzing. When I went to St. Mark's, the church had just produced its booklet, or whatever you call it, Reflections on Homosexuality, about that earlier publication. And I thought, well, we better kind of have a look at this. And I remember setting up, and I'm sure maybe David did it, Rambo, I'm not sure, but the kind of discussions that you would have, because this is an important subject. And then I showed quite an interesting film called Priest with Robert Carlyle. It's going back some time now, but it's worth getting out of a library or something. And so I'm showing this film because within the film, it shows an intimate physical relation, not pornographic or anything, but it shows two fellas kissing and cuddling and all that. And I thought, well, you know, this is what it's about. This is what we're talking about people and emotions and so on. So I'm showing this film in St. Mark's. And I turned to Christian because there are a lot of people who were nowhere near this topic, you know, and I'm thinking, what am I doing showing this, Christine? This is, you know, and I was really kind of quite scared. And do you know, people came to me and then to each other, and what they said was, not that I'm gay, but, do you know, my son's gay, or my daughter's gay, or my cousin, and they started telling stories. And suddenly, and this was back in the early 90s, suddenly, it was all right. We could talk. We could be open. We could be trusting. And then you began to think, this is no bit great shakes, really. And we're making it such great shakes. Thank you for that. Something else, something, another comment about, honest about Jesus, honest about the church.
When are
we going to be, oh, well, I've written a book on it. Do buy it. It's at the back. It's a big bugbear of mine, that. I think you can say, children can say to parents, we understand the difference between story and fact. This is a story which has lots of meanings. And I think it's in the book, all this for me started at the end of a big Christmas Eve. We used to have a big Christmas Eve children's event like many churches. And I remember the grandson of one of our members, and Johnny was only about seven, and he turned to his grandfather on the way out and said, but Grandad, is it true? And Grandad didn't know where to start, really. But, you know, children, they're not stupid, are they? And yet, you know, there's so rich, there's so much richness in the Christmas stories that you can do all kinds of things with them liturgically and so on. But you really have to get to the stage of having, be brave enough to say, we'll use these stories because they have deep messages about peace, about justice, and so on. We can use imagery of light and darkness. But, you know, it's a brave cleric who stands up in the pulpit and kind of bluntly says, but, you know, this is a story. There never were three wise men who happened to arrive at a crib following a star. But I think we've got to move on that, because otherwise the world thinks we're just... I think most people who come to church, and the churches are packed at Christmas, the only time they are, really, isn't it? I think everybody's colluding. Parents, grandparents now all know it's a lovely thing to take your children to. But for goodness sake, you know, let the world know that we're a bit more savvy about these birth narratives. Sorry? Well, I know, yeah, I know. No, but seriously, I wrote this little booklet, Christmas, Ancient Meanings, Modern Faith, which I tried to tackle some of those things. One other question, let me just... Okay, that's all right. Let's, so I think the way forward, as well as being honest, is to try to listen to voices which have pushed us in the last 30 years or so. One important voice to me has been Don Cupid and the whole Sea of Faith movement. And I don't want to go down the non-realist line tonight or anything like that. But what I found interesting about Don Cupid and some of his early books were he actually looked at the possibility of the church being reformed rather than Don now giving it all up, really, in many ways, is he talks about kingdom religion. Now, kingdom religion, according to Don, really, is very different than the institutional religion. Most institutional religions, whether they be Protestant or Catholic, as you know, needs an intermediary. The intermediary is either that book called the Bible, or it's that priest, or it's that sacrament to get to God, as it were. And Don is all about religion being immediate. It's what we now talk about when we talk about our spirituality or our mindfulness or whatever. We feel that whatever we understand by the word God, we can experience that for the here and now. We don't have to go through anybody, anything, any ritual in order to. And therefore, kingdom religion is much more democratic. It's not got this hierarchy of you shall do this, you shall believe that. So if it's much less about doctrine, and it's more about journeying. It's more personal. And it invokes those theologies like liberation theology, queer theology, black theology, feminist theology, because they're all stemming from asking the big questions about who am I in this world and what's it all about, Alfie, as it were. And that's kind of a kingdom religion because it's much more immediate and authentic and not second-hand. It's a first-hand religion. And it seems to me so much of the gospel, the way that Jesus challenged, the way that Jesus replied with questions, the way that Jesus used stories and narratives, is all about speaking to the individual or speaking to groups that he addressed. Another way of doing it is a more provocative title, like Robin Mayer's, who's well worth reading, Saving Jesus from the Church. You get the drift. You get the drift. It's trying to look at all we know about Jesus and sometimes what gets in the way. So we know that Jesus was clearly a remarkable teacher, and bringing out those questions and new understandings and insights from his listeners, rather than being regarding primarily Jesus as a saviour. So you need saving and I'm going to save you. Looking at faith, not as a system of beliefs with requirements, but as actually as being. Faith is something active now that we engage with. Easter, again, not as a lot of proof texts, but actually somehow as a presence, whatever we mean by feeling a living Lord in our life, or however we want to put that. Seeing the whole of Christianity, not as a system that can condemn people, but a system of compassion. Seeing religion as relationship and not righteousness. And of course, this is going back to Fox, seeing, not George Fox, but Matthew Fox, seeing religion as original blessing and not original sin. So you see, the drift is coming quite clearly over the last 30 years. A lot of it is coming from speakers, theologians, church people, writers in the States and in other places, where they're beginning to say, the Jesus story, honestly retold, is worth hanging on to, because it can form and it can shape not only our lives, but the shape of communities. But the trouble is, it's all got wrapped up in things that we're supposed to believe. And if you don't believe that, you're not a proper Christian and all that kind of stuff that we're all familiar with. So towards the kind of moving on through the book, I try and say, well, what would this Jesus-shaped church look like? And it's not really rocket science, and it's not rocket science for any church to move this way and away from all the tenets of faith to actually practicing being a Jesus-shaped church. And so it seems to me a Jesus-shaped church would be passionate about justice, about child poverty, really passionate about compassion, passionate about love and healing. You know, when people talk about, if I asked you, tell me about the passion of Jesus, you would tell me about Holy Week. But if I say, tell me about the passions of Jesus, oh, yes, we're into a different territory. And a Jesus-shaped church would be prophetic, would. You know, I remember in my team in Leeds, the youth officer used to have a lovely phrase where he said, the church is often, instead of being in the vanguard, is in the guard's van. Now, our generation would know what guard's van is. It doesn't work on a younger audience these days that very much. But you know what he's meaning? The church is so often in the guard's van, behind movements for change and so on, which better society. And we need to be more prophetic and inclusive, of course. And then I think the Jesus-shaped church needs to somehow, and this is difficult, be holy and mediate the sacred. And I don't mean that in any kind of wrongly pious way, but it seems to me that the Jesus who comes to us is very much the Jesus whose very presence, teachings, life, example, move us into something transcendent, something we can't quite put our fingers on, but something which is really important, which then leads on to all the church as a blessing, whether it be a couple seeking a marriage, whether it be solace after a death, whether it be new life. Somehow a Jesus-shaped church would see all those as opportunities to bless, not as opportunities to say, you want your child baptized, you've got to come to so many, and then, you know, you want to get married, no, we can't do it here, you're divorced, or you're gay, you know, being a blessing to people. And I think all of this necessarily involves being on a journey, a questioning journey, an open, discovering, never having all the answers, living the questions rather than just giving the answers, as so often the church seems to do. So I think the Jesus-shaped church could be around that. And I think, from my experience, there are many congregations who are on that journey, who are beginning to say, actually, so much of what we've been doing seems to be hierarchical, seems to be saying, you come in, we'll give you the answers. The liturgy seems to be singing and saying things which we don't actually believe anymore. The liturgy keeps talking about God as a man. Well, God isn't a man. And everybody, oh, of course, God isn't a man in the sky, but we just keep losing this masculine language in all our prayers. As though it's, you know, Heavenly Father is just, well, that's fine, isn't it? Well, it's not. It doesn't make honest sense. If you don't believe God is a man, use language, and back to John Robinson, for goodness sake, you know, use language which begins to reflect the truth about God, for example. And I finish with two quotes, and then we can really open it up for the last few minutes. I love this quote from Richard Holloway. He's one of my favourite protagonists in the House of Bishops, or was. Hierarchical Christianity is heavy with the pride of office and the dignity of person. It is cluttered with ceremonial deference. It is burdened with brocaded magnificence. It is choreographed with minute attention to processional precedence. It is ranked and graded like a hive of bees. And this strikes me time and again. When I was in Leeds, Leeds Parish Church became a minster, and they thought they had to invite the deans from all the neighbouring minsters. They had to be ecumenical and invite people from other denominations. They had bishops, archdeacons. They had different faith traditions. And we were all stood there. Then they had people like odd officers like me. They had the clergy and readers of the church and so on. And we were all in this huge vestry in Leeds Parish Church. And you should have seen how complicated it was for the Master of Ceremonies to devise a procession where the most important person was there and the least important person, woman reader, was there. And it was everything that, you know, it seems to me our Lord would have laughed at. So I leave you with another quote, a much more, for me, encouraging quote from Mark Oakley, who's doing great things, it seems to me, at St. Paul's and in London. This is what he wants of St. Paul's Cathedral, and I think it's a wish that I would want of everywhere. That he wants St. Paul's to be less a fortress of faith and more a resource for the soul. So over to you. That's it, I'm afraid. That's all you're getting.
Cadrian's come all the way down from Sheffield to be with us tonight, and that was really, really food for thought. I hope it will keep us talking and it won't sort of end here. But thank you so much for coming, Adrian, and it's been a lovely evening to be with you. So thank you.